Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys were rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take it.
Give me all you got!
Listen.
Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and joining me for episode 135, minute 135 of Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus, is one of the rare remaining Australian film critics that is working at a large publication. They don't exist. They're an endangered species. There are a bunch of us freelancers out there, but there are some fixtures of our cultural sort of storytelling and appraising of art in Australian media landscape. I'm talking to one of those right now, so it's a rare bird that I'm speaking to. We are watching Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus Heat together, the original theatrical version. It's 2 hours and 14 minutes on your dial, 135 minutes into One Heat Minute podcast. The gentleman that I'm speaking to is a writer for The Age newspaper in Australia, previously a co-editor of Senses of Cinema, has written for the Australian Book Review, and is just a seasoned film critic in the landscape, and comes with high recommendation from another seasoned veteran of the Australian cultural landscape, Philippa Hawker. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jake Wilson to the show. Jake, welcome to One Heat Minute.
Hi, Blake. It's very nice to be here. And I should say I identify as a freelancer rather than as a fixture, I will say, even though I've been through this for a long time. I definitely don't feel like a fixture.
I think everyone who feels like a fixture doesn't have the right mindset. So I think that's a good mindset to have in this contemporary flux that we're in, but that's good. For folks who are listening, if you're not in Oz, you can find Jake on all the things that you can find for international critics, the Rotten Tomatoes and the like. But he writes for our Age papers here. So, mate, thank you for being a part of the show. I appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
And so, right now, I'm dragging Jake in right in the deep end of this movie, right in a very, a critical emotional moment for the character of Neil McCauley. And, a few mere episodes ago, you guys would have heard Garth Franklin and Stu Coote and I, sort of seasoned vets of the show, talking about this real tension of the Neil McCauley and Edie relationship. And the last time we saw them on screen together, it's got a feeling of Stockholm syndrome. So in the present minute, so minute 134 and 5, this scene of them sort of making a brief pit stop before ultimately going to their end destination, or what they think that is, heading to the airport, Neil and Edie stop. And it's a moment where Neil is pleading with Edie. Robert De Niro's Neil is pleading with Amy Brenneman's Edie to sort of stay a part of his life. And it is a fascinating scene in the context of their character arc. And I can't wait to unpack it with Jake. So what we're going to do now is we're going to check it out with you guys, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about it.
There's no point in me going anywhere anymore. It's going to be alone without you. Edie.
Well, I thought, you know, when I first saw this, I thought, well, four shots. How much could happen in four shots? But a lot does happen.
That's exactly right. A lot happens. And especially, we kind of buried the lead there, but the coda of that shot, the post Edie and Neil roadside, is leading up to one of the other most powerful and important moments of this film. You know, a sort of, I don't know, it's like a false climax. It's like the end of an act of the entire movie, right? If this is sometimes people, you know, in sort of broad storytelling terms in filmmaking, they always talk about the three-act structure. But if you sort of prescribe to anyone who says, no, it's more of like a Shakespearean five-act structure, it's like we're heading into the end of act four right now, like basically, if you're talking about that. Yeah. And then we're rolling into the conclusion of the film. But, yeah, I just that moment strikes me so much because we're sort of at the conclusion of Neil sort of pleading with Edie, and I just think it's just a really ballsy thing for a director and a performer to know that they're basically out of focus in the shot and still to have the power to convey emotions and sort of melt away their armor and be convinced that this is a good idea.
Well, I mean, one of the issues, the questions, I guess, watching this, and maybe you have more of a theory about this than I do, is why does Edie change her mind in the end? Because, she, as you say, last time we saw her, she was, you know, not really in a place where she wanted to be part of this guy's life.
No, I don't know, Jake. I float between different opinions on Edie myself. You know, the last scene, it's, you know, I think in the context of the movie, the thing I like to just remind people about the relationship, because some people are, you know, this is an element of the film that just doesn't work for them. You know, the Edie storyline is a really challenging one. And I think it's challenging because it's uncomfortable. Like the scenes are genuinely have a great deal of tension. I don't think the performances are bad. I think the performances are top notch, but I just think their arc is, you know, it comes with it a lot of conflict because you see Neil, you don't know whether Neil's lying to himself. You don't know whether Edie is lying to herself. And the answer is probably that they're both lying to themselves. And also, you know, these two lonely people have sort of lightning struck them, but they've only really had a couple of interactions. They're still in this like heightened state of like gushy, lovey sort of thing. And I think for all of us, it's kind of unfathomable to think about meeting someone, having two dates, and then potentially that you watch them on the news all day murdering people. Like, I just don't understand what that would feel like.
And then you say, yes, okay, this is somebody I want to give my life to.
Yeah. Is this the person that I want to live my life with? And I don't know. But, it, you know, how lonely is one going to be? How much is this beautiful fantasy of escaping and living a romantic life forever, you know, how much of a grind has she been on? Like, she's not 22, you know, maybe she's like 28 or 29. She's close to 30. You know, they are still, you know, age appropriate to an extent.
She's a lot younger.
And yeah, a lot younger, but you know, not like 22. Like she's, you know, she's a little bit older. Maybe she's been out in LA for a decade, you know, since college in New York. And maybe life's going nowhere, and maybe this is like the golden ticket, and it's just unfathomable that he's this dude.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a lot of things in this movie for me. Like, if I start to think about them rationally too hard, I'm like, would this happen? Could this happen? But in the sort of flow of the movie, the way it's orchestrated, the way it's been built up to, I kind of accept it.
Yes, agree. Totally agree. When you scrutinize things every 60 seconds of a movie, and you try and prescribe, we try and prescribe like authentic reality on it sometimes, even though the movie, you know, for all of its operatic melodrama in a way, it's got this real anchor in authentic reality. But I think that, like I think we forgive some of the melodrama, or we forgive some of these heightened emotions, because it's literally chunking, you know, a massive conflicted relationship and a mini arc, and it's trying to be punchy and economical and still keep this thing moving. Like, it's a 166 odd minute movie with, you know, before credits, about 170 minutes with credits. But yeah, it's that kind of momentum that we're trying to maintain here. So this, you know, in a longer storyline perhaps, or a longer movie that was maybe less well constructed around how to pace out an ending, it would give you more time with these characters, but would it feel slow and would it lag and take away from the other blistering sort of downhill momentum that we have towards this ending?
Well, I mean, if Mann were doing, you know, Heat now, he might say, okay, it's going to be an 8-hour Netflix series. And that would be a whole different proposition.
Absolutely.
You know, it might be also great. But I'm glad that we have the 3-hour version, which is with all one experience, and we don't have it spaced out.
Yeah, I think it's something different. You know, that's one thing another great podcast does. On the Ringer Podcast Network, Bill Simmons' podcast network, they have a show called The Rewatchables. And that's one of his fundamental questions when they go back to these movies that they, you know, they celebrate their rewatchability. He's like, would this movie now be a Netflix series? But I think, you know, you're a cinephile. You're a guy who obviously watches a ton of movies and has a theatrical experience. And I just wonder, you know, in your sort of, in your upbringing in the Melbourne suburbs near Valhalla Cinema, where was Heat a movie that you watched and you got to see in the cinema before even before you started writing about films?
Oh, sure, yeah. And let me think. No, it would be before I started writing about films, but it's 95, so I would have been, I guess, 17, yes, roughly, when I saw it. So that's an impressionable age. So about the same year as Casino, I think.
Exactly the same year. Two big De Niro movies came out that year.
Yeah. So, I'm not sure if I was 100% sold on it at 17. I was very picky at that age. I think maybe I thought it was a bit over the top. I probably like it better now. 17.
That's funny that you're more discerning viewer at 17.
I was more of a snob at 17, I think. But no, I mean, not necessarily, because I liked action movies. I remember I was, you know, very big on Speed, which had come out, I think, the previous year. But I think I thought there was something a bit of grandiosity to Heat that at that time rubbed me the wrong way. But I will say I tend to have that thing with Michael Mann movies in particular, where I need to see them twice before I start to appreciate them.
Yes.
I really had that with Public Enemies. The first time I was like bamboozled by it, and the second time I loved it. So,
and what about Miami Vice?
Almost, I need to go back to Miami Vice again. When I saw it in the cinema, I was like, well, there aren't a lot of characters in this apart from Gong Li, but I need to go back to it.
It'd be an interesting one for you to, but I think that maybe is why people like this show, is because Heat is a movie that feels like it's more something that can be savored. Like you can watch it again and again and you feel like you're taking a new lens to it. You know, as a lot of people say, when you have a particularly dense movie, I think the most striking contrast for me was like, I deeply hated Terrence Malick's The Thin Red Line the first time I saw it. I deeply hated it. And it just haunted me. I think that weird, nondescript, disembodied voiceover, like the poetic poetics that sort of underscored a lot of what was happening, whether it was like sometimes it was like right on point and other times it felt incongruous, they just haunted me for like weeks. And I went back and watched it and I was like, God, this movie's a masterpiece. You know, it just had this like absolute turn on a dime, hated it and loved it, and completely struck by it. But I think that that's like, you know, all the best movies are worth watching again. I think that sometimes people have got like this obsessive, like, oh, I have to see all new movies. It's like, no. You can slow down. You can, you know, there are movies that are worth your time to reinvest in. That's how people figure out that they're masterpieces, because you watch them again and again and again and they continue to stand the test of time and repeat viewings.
Well, exactly. I mean, you see something once, you say it's a masterpiece, you're kind of guessing, you know, because you don't know. So those multiple viewings, or if you're going to lose interest. But yeah, I think Mann is a little bit like Malick in that way, and that there's a very particular sensibility, and you can react sort of positively or negatively to it when you first see one of their films. But then, you know, you if you keep going back, you have to admit that this is really kind of textured. You know, there's a lot of artistry in this, whether it's kind of your cup of tea or not.
Yes. That's so funny you say that. I think that's one of the best lines I've heard in this entire show. It's like, if you say a movie's a masterpiece on first viewing, you're just guessing. You are absolutely just guessing. That is fantastic. You know, it's funny that, you know, I didn't mean to stumble into Malick, but with Mann, it's like they're essentially in the same class of filmmakers. Like, Malick is probably his closest contemporary in a weird way as a filmmaker who started making films. You know, Mann made his telemovie Jericho Mile around the same time as Malick made Badlands. And then Malick, in his weird, protracted, I'm going to make a movie every 10 years and then, like, suddenly I'm going to make 4 movies in 4 years. He had this sort of weird run. Michael Mann sort of made a movie and then went back to television for many years and then makes 2 movies, then goes back to television for many years, then makes another movie, then back to television again for an amount of time. I feel like those two guys, I don't know whether they do have this weird intrinsic connection in that class of filmmakers that all emerged out of New Hollywood that, you know, they sort of were operating on the fringes and they're not really kept in the, you know, they're not talked about in the same class as your Malicks you're not talked about in the same class as the De Palmas and the Spielbergs and the Coppolas. Like, they're not in that little clique. They're sort of on the fringes of that, but they're all very much from and of that time. And they're just different. People took different expressions with how they were going to explore that time on screen.
Well, they're both guys who have somehow figured out how to make really quite experimental films on a on Hollywood type budgets, which I guess is getting harder and harder to do.
Yes,
but and they're also romantics, I think, in the broader sense, both of them. And people, both of them, are kind of about straining after, you know, some kind of sublime experience, which is always kind of out of reach. I guess there's an emotional connection between them in that way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that brings us perfectly back to the beginning of this minute, which is, you know, right at the end. I'm sorry to bring you in. So, you know, this is the thrill and the agony of this discipline, is that sometimes you're brought into the middle of a scene or the lovely person before you, is another amazing Melbourne-based film critic, the lovely Joanna De Mattia. And so, Joanna's going to be cheated of this conclusion to her minute. But I think it's, as we get back here to De Niro performing to Edie and making this plea, like, it is, I mean, from the guy who was looking in her eyes, pleading for her to, you know, that this is all going to be over soon, to the guy that's here, they feel like different people. Like, this is the talent of De Niro. Like, the sincerity level in this guy's face, like, he feels like he believes it. And the pleading in the, you know, aforementioned scene is, like, desperate. You know, it's incongruous completely to the character. But I think here he's just, I don't know, it's just something about the centeredness and the look and the anchor and the framing. Like, again, Spinotti has lit the living daylights out of this scene. It just looks like, it looks like you feel like Edie could let the armor down with this guy, but definitely not the guy in the last scene.
I feel like the composition here really works, but it's sort of totally unrealistic. Like, why would he stand behind her in this way? You know, rather than at least sort of trying to make some eye contact, why would he be kind of hovering over her? It doesn't really make sense to me as like how two people would actually engage, but it works because we need to see them both in this case. And of course, you know, there's lots and lots of scenes in this film where we're looking at one person or another, and we're not looking at both people at once. I mean, the diner scene is built on the idea that we're not looking at both people at once, but here we need to see both people, even if not in focus.
Yes, and also I think, there's like a weird sense of like freedom in this moment that she's refusing to even look at him.
Yeah,
so like true. I think that adds to the tension of the scene. It's like, I feel like in the previous scene, I think you may have just nailed it, right? Which is like literally the physicality of the scene and the relationship between bodies in a space. It's like when he's right in her face, he's threatening.
Yeah.
But I think here, her turned away, her slightly out of focus, at her out of front, he's kind of having to convince her with none of the tools of like intimidation or anything like that. He just has to pour his soul out. And if she turns around, she's coming with him. And if she doesn't turn, he's got to go.
It's that simple. And that makes it so visual. And she's completely, you know, she kind of is in her own space. And we don't really know up to the moment when she turns, when she goes away, we don't really know what she's thinking. We know she's processing.
Yes.
We know she's taking it all in, but we don't know, you know, which way she's going to go. And we don't know what she's making of any specific thing he says.
No, and it's also like, so I'm just sort of playing this for Jake and I, guys, while you guys are listening. And it's really only about 10 seconds into this scene, and I'm just doing it in silence for the, you know, as we often do on the show. But it's like 10 seconds into this scene before even you even get maybe some cards being revealed on what her decision may be, with just sort of an opening of the mouth, a release of the jaw. It's like I feel like this is just a great bit of, you know, just shows Amy Brenneman's fantastic aptitude for a performance here. It's like something about a clenched face and then just relinquishing a bit of stress lines there. It's just starting to tell us so much before the music cue comes in. So there's a very pronounced music cue, I think, adding to that operatic, romantic sort of thing that's happening here. But yeah, so when she's here and she's turning, and you're starting to see the release and the reprieve, it takes some time. And then the music is there, and I think it's that final moment where Neil just says, like, he lays it out all on the table.
And then there's a pause.
And there's a nice meaty pause, and he's just like, Edie. It's like this thing, I don't know where, this that final nail where she can't resist anymore at that point. She's like, everything's down, she blinks, she looks down, the music cue engages, and she turns. And even when she turns, he still kind of looks hopeful and sincere. He's not saying, you know, you need to go, you need to stay. And when she grabs him, I love the touch of her grabbing his shirt and sort of pounding on his chest. Like, you know, it's a much more muted version of like the, why did you do this to me, that we see in an earlier scene, you know, like, why did you do this to me? And then the connection of their faces here, where she barely, where she like recoiled from his face in the previous scene. I think it's just that, okay, here's the armor down, you know, Neil's. And I think also it's so hard to do, but like, I try and imagine what it was like watching this the first time, going, oh, Neil's going to get away now.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you thought?
Yeah. I guess like, you're like, oh, it's almost impossible, right? You see, you're like, the good guy's going to win, is basically what you think. But in this moment, you're like, no, Neil's going to get away. Like, he made the choice. Edie's going to go with him and they're going to get away.
Well, I'll tell you what I think I thought. I might be wrong about this because I'm going back, over 20 years. But I think I thought this was like the classic film noir thing, or like Le Samurai, you know, where the guy is undone by love, you know. He's a pro, he knows exactly what he's doing, and then he allows, like, emotion to creep in, and that undoes him. And in fact, that is not what undoes it.
No. No, he's programming. Like, the love in this case, which is cool, like, it's sort of anti-genre, even though it adheres to so many of those same genre tropes as Le Samurai and those noir films. In this moment, the love is the escape. Like, being willing to adhere to his philosophy of, like, when you spot the heat around the corner, get out of here. I think one of the funny lines that has happened in this show was Bill Gabeary's first appearance on the show. He says, not only does this guy not escape when the heat is around the corner, he doesn't escape when the heat is in front of him at a coffee table. Like, that's like that is, and I think about that sometimes and I just sort of chuckle to myself, exactly as you just did, because like right now the escape is here. Like, the fantasy's real. In this moment, the fantasy's real. And I think that, you know, whatever conflict you have however challenged you are in those two scenes in isolation, I think in the context of the movie, I love that they work. And I think that they also work together as like two little mini essays about, you know, people being broken down by the situation and having a little bit of framing and context. And then also, you know, the thought of go or stay and that wrestle, right? And wanting to be in love. That's the other thing. I think like we're at the 38th second of this minute and this frame is just so perfect. Like, there's, you know, these two people in this frame I should take a snap of it because it's just so lovely. Like, they want to be in love in this moment.
Yeah.
They absolutely look like two people who want to be in love. And so right now, this is it.
Mm. I was afraid when I came on here that I wouldn't have anything to say, and I have so many things to say. One thing I wanted to say was that what really makes the moment for me is the moment of almost physical clumsiness in Daenerys' reaction when she turns around and she almost throws herself at him, and he almost recalls, like, oh, here's this woman doing this, and I don't quite know how to respond. I'm not quite in the moment. And you talked about, you know, these scenes being uncomfortable, and I think, you know, De Niro is the master of emotional discomfort. You know, he never ever plays a guy who is at ease with it.
Yes.
He always plays somebody who's kind of clumsily trying to process whatever it is he's feeling, and you know, kind of stumbling through it a bit. And that's what gives it a bit of authenticity, I think.
Yeah, I think the wrestle of the great De Niro characters between, you know, you can even go back to, like, Taxi Driver. The wrestle between, like, reality and psychotic fantasy. Like, that's an extreme example. But, like, the wrestle between those two things is so fascinating. He's such a phenomenal performer for wrestling between those two things.
Yeah.
And it's like, even, like, Raging Bull as well, as, like, it's about being loved and adoration and then making people love you. Like, there's this weird connect, like, being loved and being adored is like this huge motivation in this guy, and that manifests itself in, like, violence, sexual violence, like, obsession, paranoia, all those things. But it's like, it's the two draws at the, you know, the beginning and end of the movie, at the peak of his career as LaMotta, and then later on when he's a comedian, like, there's this similar arc of adoration that's there. And I think that's here what's so great about this tension is there is a guy who is at odds with the fantasy version of who he thinks he should be, and his philosophy and the programming that he's had to maintain to stay alive and to stay free. And so I think that in this moment, it's, yeah, like you said, I think the sincerity of the moment, he's not even prepared for her to say yes. I think that maybe is probably where we're nailing it. It's like, right in this moment, I don't think he knows whether she's going to say yes or not. And even if he does, obviously he does, he's read the script. But I think the mastery of his performance is that awkwardness makes us believe that maybe he didn't think it was going to happen.
That's what actors can do. They can actually get to a point where they're surprised by what's happened. Even though they've read the script, they kind of they're genuinely in the moment. They are genuinely surprised. I don't know how they do it.
I don't know how he does it. I mean, again, you're talking about a guy in 95. What's he made, 30 movies by this time? Like 30 movies, let's say, you know, 30 movies, some of the biggest movies ever made. How's he still surprising? You know, maybe in 2019 we can talk about whether or not he's still able to surprise, but most certainly at 95, I think it's like the peak of his, you know, one of his other career peaks, you know, his early peaks, and this is like such a strong part of his career.
It's funny, one you hadn't mentioned, which I was just watching a few weeks ago because it was on at the Melbourne Cinematheque, is Once Upon a Time in America.
Oh, great movie.
Yeah, and there's really quite a bit. I was surprised looking at Heat again that it does have kind of something in common with Once Upon a Time in America, in that it's very much about time, like either, you know, time kind of being extended or like never enough time running out, which is what De Niro's character here is all about.
He's all about that, and I think that's a great sort of manipulation of that, like people in power, in charge, free time, like literally, you know, sometimes the earth is like a ticking time bomb that's going to go off, like the rotations of the world. And I've had some great theories that I'll tease in more detail for later, but I've had some great theories that this movie's amount of time is also very interesting. You know, that it's like, you know, if you look at, you know, the sunrise and sets from the beginning of the movie, is this the last 7 days of Neil McCauley's life? And so... So some really interesting stuff that we could talk about there. But in this climactic moment, this romantic moment, you know, they're going to cherish their time together and they're going to live this fantasy. And, you know, with 20 seconds to go, these are two people that are in love and they're going to try and overcome this chaos.
And yet, if you look very briefly, there's a look in his eyes of, oh, I've still got to be somewhere. You know, I can't for the moment.
That is the beauty of just seconds in this movie. In one moment, Neil is assured, Edie is comfortable, and in an upcoming scene, one of the most iconic, the upcoming drive and tunnel scenes of this movie, you watch Neil go from this guy, this sincere guy, this guy is ready to live this fantasy, to merge fantasy and reality and sort of discard the programming and the discipline and the code that he's had to live by. And then a phone call, an impulse, a piece of information can really flip that on its head.
So many things I want to say. One is about the ocean, which, you know, obviously is all through the film.
Yes.
But, you know, it's so important that you have the sound of the ocean here, and also the sound of the birds, the just before dawn kind of feeling. The sense of, oh, we're waiting for the dawn to break. But when you were talking about release, I was thinking, well, this is kind of what Michael Mann does over and over, this kind of build up and release. And, you know, it's linked to that idea of the waves breaking, and they keep breaking and they keep breaking, and the tide keeps flowing on. And that's kind of the feeling of the whole film for me.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that he's got a great command of, like, that there's a cyclical nature in a lot of his stories. Things move on, you know, things live, things die. It's part of the process. And what's cool about Michael Mann movies, in some really pronounced ways, and some really sort of minor ways, that like time's going to just keep moving. So these characters are just in a moment in time. And I think, like, you look at his biopic Ali, it's very much that. Like, he takes a real different approach. He's not trying to tell a life story. He's kind of telling, you know, two parts of a story. It's not a triptych. It's kind of a two-hander where it's like, this is the beginning of this guy's career where everything is going right and everything is perfect. And then, you know, this is the thing that he had to drag himself out of, you know, later on. So it's like these two portraits 10 years apart almost. And then you get with like Miami Vice, especially the theatrical cut version, it's just Colin Farrell's character, Sonny, just walking into the back of an emergency room in the movie going to the credits. It's like, these guys are going to keep working. Yeah, you know, these guys are just going to keep working. And I think that's what's very cool in some of these movies. They're just going to keep doing their thing. They're just going to keep living their lives. They're going to just move on.
Until eventually they hit a wall or they yes. die. Or, you know, nothing's going to last forever.
Nothing lasts forever.
It's going until it doesn't.
Exactly. It's so fatalistic. But I think that's why we're drawn to it, right? It's just this great kind of like reprieve of like, things are cyclical. Time is luck, you know, that, you know, time, you know, I'm going to wake up before I, you know, drown in my sleep. You know, De Niro's character even says those words.
Yeah, he does. Yes. And he talks about, his dream of being submerged. This is what interests me really about De Niro's character. I hadn't really thought about it till I went back to the film again, that Pacino asks him, are you doing what you want to do? And he says no.
Whereas, he goes, no, not yet.
No, not yet. Whereas Pacino is doing what he wants to do. I mean, he's having the time of his life in some sense. But
I think that, you know how voice, and I think that's a great point. That's a great take. Like, what is he actually talking about? But the way I've always read that is that, like, Neil McCauley is totally Neil McCauley in a heist. He's like Chris. I had a great... And I'll actually see if I can find the tweet today. I'll get lots of, you know, great tweets, great emails. So thank you so much for everyone who does. And I had a really good one today. And so this will be slightly after it actually occurred, but I'll shout it out anyway because I liked the tweet. So earlier today I was talking to a guy by the name of Andy Elijah, and he said he always had a take about Chris, and I know this is not necessarily De Niro, but Chris in the heist scene, like not giving the crooks a chance to get away by opening fire.
Mm-hmm. Okay, he's that's like, interesting.
Yeah, well, that was his take. I said, that's an interesting take, right? And I said, I always thought that Chris, people like Chris and people like Neil, if they see the threat, they are hardwired to kill it. Like there's no hesitation. They see two cops who are armed, it's go. Like it's on. And I think that that's the, after that state when Neil's like, not yet, I've always thought about it in the context of the heist. Maybe it's because where it is in the movie and the flow of everything, but I've always reflected, like, when Neil is most Neil, he's in that heist, he's executing a plan to perfection, it's going off without a hitch. But, you know, that's a really interesting take. But to your point, Vincent is having the time of his life. Because Vincent, like, you know, usually just gnawing on prey, whether he's, like, chewing scenery with Albert Torino or he's got Tone Loke in a headlock. You know, it's all, like, he's having a ball when anyone's in front of him just chewing up, you know, Hank Azaria's Alan Marciano. Like, they're all just, like, little snacks for him. But, like, De Niro's, like... He's the main course. He's the pièce de résistance. He's there, right there. And so yeah, but it's a great thought to think back. Like, what is he saying in that moment? Is there a moment where is it the heist or is it the completion of the perfection? Like is he most near when he's looking out that window to that sublime water? You talked about the ocean themes in this movie. Is he that guy that's looking out to that ocean and I've completed something perfectly and I feel good about it, or is he? I don't know. Is it the heist? I don't know. I don't think we can have an answer. I kind of like not having an answer.
It's good not having an answer. And there's definitely a lot of room for speculation about this. My sense in there is that, you know, what defines him maybe is having been in prison.
Yes.
And, you know, and probably whatever he went through in prison did destroy some part of his soul. You know, and in some ways he is a dead man walking. He's not. You know, which is maybe why he is so emotionally shut down until this moment when he's not. And then, you know, I think he is looking for something to wake him up emotionally. And he's looking for a sort of freedom which he hasn't got yet. I guess that's what I take from that line.
Yeah. And there's a weird line, you know, in the much derided Black Hat, you know, where Chris Hemsworth character says, and I think it might even be in Jericho Miles saying, like, I do the time doesn't do me. And you get a sense, and you get a sense that when he says it, and, you know, obviously, let's just put it unequivocally out there. Like, in my mind, Black Hat is not as good a movie as Heat for you Black Hat apologists out there. Like, let's just stop. But I think one thing that really resonates for that line is, does anyone actually think that their time is not doing them? You know, do they believe it? Like, they can say the mantra. You know, it's almost like, do you say it to convince yourself that the impacts of prison psychologically, physically, mentally, whatever it is, are not actually occurring and you're doing the time right? But it's like, Neil, like you said, that imprint, it's there. Like, this guy's done his time, he's learned his crafts and trade in there. He's not living a free life necessarily. It's all this really weird isolated thing.
It's a bit the same thing. Well, it is the same thing pretty much with the character in Thief.
Yes.
Who has a sort of fantasy about what like a perfect life would be, but it is so constructed and artificial that it's almost like another kind of trap.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that you know, he's working on these same themes or similar themes in a lot of movies, sort of essaying different things, whether it's, you know, I think it's like, it is really overt, I like, in Public Enemies as far as like looking at criminal infamy. You know, looking at taking it, like, if you look at, there's no two different people than John Dillinger and Neil McCauley. Like, Neil McCauley does everything to be invisible, and John Dillinger is, you know, he waltzes into places like Vincent Hanna waltzes into a crime scene. Like, it's the show pony version of that. And you know, you look at Christian Bale as an example, and Christian Bale's the Neil McCauley of police when he's, you know, when he's hunting after him, because he's just clinical. He has a process. Yeah. He follows it. It's like the complete inverse of those two sort of personality traits. And so it's sort of fun to watch how it manifests itself. But, like, I think, you know, I think with him, yeah, I love what you said there, Jake. And I love the room for speculation is so underrated. Like, in so many movies, it's so overtly prescribed on every single character, motion, movement, you know, emotional trajectory, decision. And sometimes you're like, can I just be mildly ambivalent about any of the characters here and what their motivations are? Because I think that as soon as you do that, people just instantly drive with characters, and they don't, you know, sometimes they can't quite put their finger on it. But then at the end of it, it's like, no, I like, because I wasn't 100% sure why they made that decision, or I wasn't 100% happy with those two corresponding decisions because they didn't seem to make sense, but it was like what they needed to do to get through. And yeah, it's so good.
The other thing that struck me, and this is getting a little away from our sort of specified minute, but looking at it again, is that in some strange way, it's almost a story of unrequited love, because Vincent is really a lot more obsessed with Neil than Neil ever is with Vincent.
Oh, I think Neil plays it cool. You know, the one reason that I totally agree with you, but the one reason I just be a little bit more is I can't fathom why the guy who's so codified and who has this program that says if the heat is around the corner that you should drop everything, when he sees Vincent and Vincent thinks he's good, he has a deep desire to overwhelm him. Like, he can't wait to say, oh, you think you've got me? Like, that's the hubris creeping in. Like, there's something about that's where he taps into a little bit of that Dillinger, right? Which is like the whole, you know, he's been Mr. Invisible. Like, who's the loner? Yeah. Like, everything up until that point, who's the loner? Oh, this guy's good, everything. And when he sits in front of Vincent, there's something that is in his smile at the end of that minute. He's like, oh, maybe we'll never see each other again. And it's like peeking your head out and becoming re-invisible again. I just love that there is something. But to your point, Vincent is absolutely obsessed with Neil. But I just think that there's something that Neil likes about it. Neil's interested.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's not completely one-sided. But
he's giving him just enough of a hint that he maybe likes him too. That it's like it helps transcend. But I agree. Like Vincent because Vincent hasn't met anyone like Neil before. Neil assumes at the beginning that he's met people like Vincent, but he's got a level of tenacity and things that most of the time he's like, Jesus Christ, what the fuck? How did these guys even come on us? Like, I think he's even surprised at how close Vincent got to do it. So he now has to raise the stakes and go, all right, it's all in to get out. And that's it.
That's just about it.
So we head into, back to our minute, we head back. It's 46 seconds into the minute and we're down into Venice Beach and we're seeing a car pull up to Venice Beach in LA. We're getting this beautiful, we edit from, you know, this sort of pit stop, this lonely car coming down the road, a SWAT team member puts their eyes on it. You cut into the eyes of another SWAT team member and then another one with like what looks like infrared glasses and a camera. Oh, and he's got a rock ROCK on the back of his SWAT helmet. So that's a cool nickname. But we're now right in the thick of. At the moment, we're not quite sure where we are. If you just pause it right here, but for those of you who are listening, and I'm assuming that if you're now up to minute 135 of the One Heat Minute podcast, I'm assuming you may have seen the film. So we can say we're heading right into what is just a glorious minute again. You know, filled with uncertainty and tension and filled with, am I going to do what is ultimately the thing that's going to make me survive and live happily ever after? Or am I going to risk it? Or am I going to take a massive risk and risk myself and risk my son and risk the life of my husband who's on the run? And we get a lovely minute here, but just a nice piece of, I don't know, like it's almost like horror story anticipation, an ambush coming.
And what's crucial in the context of this minute is that the music continues from the one scene to the other and just flows us straight over and says, you know, in a way, this is a continuation of the same movement. Yes. And, of course, we're looking at two couples. I mean, ultimately, this is going to be the story of another couple whose situation is parallel and, you know, a similar choice being made.
Yes. So good. Yeah, it's good when you get those nice little mirrored cues that work from one scene to the other. I think that this movie is full of mirrored moments and full of match cuts and full of beautiful little cues that carry through. And it's like, I was talking with a friend the other day who's like, we were talking about how underrated sometimes it is to have character themes in movies, like in scores. Like, you know, you think of the classic, like a Star Wars, like the Luke Skywalker theme is absolutely undeniable and iconic. And like that, you hear it, you know, you hear that little flurry that you saw on Tatooine for the first time in Star Wars: New Hope, and it just makes your heart sore because there's some like intrinsic connection you have to them. And I think that in Heat, what's right, it's not necessarily a character theme here, but being tied into like to help cue without like being too manipulative on your emotions, but like going, you're about to now come into this moment, you know, you sort of subconsciously, you're now going to come into another place where people are faced with a shitty choice that is probably not going to go well. I think it's really cool to just be like, all right, we're going to set the scene. We're keeping with the same theme here of this moment. So, you know, it sort of gives you a clue as to where it's going to go just prior to getting into this minute.
I think the whole way Michael Mann tells stories is basically musical. I mean, I feel like the whole thing is orchestrated.
Yes.
And it's themes weaving in together and, as you say, echoes and contrasts of dynamics and so on. And there's an abstract side to it, even though it's all really, really specific.
He does have a jazz, Michael Mann. He does have a jazz. He's got his jazz moments. But, yeah, like I think you're so right that it is a... There is a flow, and that was characteristic of, you know, his early TV work. You know, Miami Vice, sort of, you know, a lot of people just talk about the Pink Flamingos and things like that. But it is a really gritty and dark show. Has great music choices. You know, really dynamically shot. Everyone in their dog got their start in it. Bruce Willis, Liam Neeson. Like, obviously, Don Johnson was the biggest TV star in the world for a very long time. Lots of great actors sort of percolated through. But it's just, you know, energy, tone, and music having such an intrinsic, you know, relationship with his stuff is, you're so right on that. I think that that's this movie. It's a big opera. It's a big opera. A really great.
Enemies, which I've come to love, really is a jazz film. I mean, literally set in the 30s, but what it sort of goes off on strange tangents and doing variations on themes we've seen a million times, and then almost sort of pushing to the point where it stops making sense. I mean, it's why, I mean, and what it does with digital video, obviously. I mean,
yes.
Which is why I found it so hard to take the first time, I think, because I was like, what the hell is he doing?
What are you doing? Yeah, but I agree with you. I was a bit shocked with it, but I think it's so beautiful. There are just so many, especially now that, you know, our mode of viewing is like 4K, you know, everything. Everyone's got a high definition television. So I think if you revisit, you know, as grating as it may have been at the time on both your cinema screen and your standard TV, when you now watch it, it's just like, oh, okay, cool. Like it's like that grating shock that we had at the time is like, oh no, this is just movies now. This is how movies look.
That was the moment of the great crossover from shooting on film to shooting digitally. I mean, you know, most things I think then would still have been majority of big movies probably still on film. So we're seeing it a different way, perhaps.
Yeah, and also, you know, he did it much more overtly with Collateral earlier. That was, like, stylistically important. But I think that people had this sort of sacred, if you're going to shoot anything that is period film-based, you would want the film stock in a way. I think that's, like, it's a weird formal, like, expectation that people have. If you're going to shoot a movie that's based in that time, maybe you should shoot it in film or you should shoot it in this. And I think that, like, real cinephiles like a Tarantino is like obsessed with making, you know, if you're shooting Kill Bill and it's a particularly sort of Shaw Brothers Hong Kong embracing that sort of flavor, he's like making the film grain look like that. So, you know, shooting it on crappy cameras and things like that to give it the same texture and like it being so important to some people, whereas Mann's like, no. It's the 1930s. They're wearing the clothes. They're in the era. Everything's meticulously, you know, curated. But I'm shooting it on blistering high definition, and I'm going to show you every fiber of this jacket and every curve of this beautiful 30s car. You know, I'm going to show you everything in the most crisp detail possible.
I love it. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a perfect, as we've just dived into romance and bad choices, I think us loving a little bit of Public Enemies is a great way to go out for this moment, because we're about to come into another tension with Public Enemy number 2 on the list of heat, which is Christian Hairless evading the police, or will he? How will he get out of this? We don't know. If you've seen this movie a million times like Jake and I have, I'm sure there's no secret, but we just love this next scene. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Mr. Jake Wilson, the critic for The Age. Jake, thank you so much for being a part of the show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Blake. It's been a pleasure.
See, and look, he thought that he'd only have 10 things to say or 10 minutes of time to take him. Here we are back at the standard, nearly an hour on this show talking about Heat. Guys, thank you so much for listening to One Heat Minute. I've, as always, been your host, Blake Howard, at Blake is Batman on Twitter. Anything you want to find out about the show is at oneheatminute.com. We are flying into the end of this show. So July of this year, we will have this entity, this beast that is One Heat Minute, living and breathing with every single minute covered. We have an amazing cache of guests coming up, Jake obviously being one of them, but we are lining up into some serious minutes. So I am really looking forward to you guys. You would have heard the upcoming episodes as a teaser episode before, but you're going to hear them again. Luke Doolin, Academy Award nominated filmmaker and editor of Animal Kingdom, and Henry Nixon, AFI or Actor Award winner, as well as just a man about town, Australian town and LA town, both doing a double episode for the next couple of minutes, and then just absolutely stacked crazy guests coming up. So looking forward to sharing that with you. But until next time, we'll catch you in another episode of 1 8 Minute just around the corner.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.